Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Folks, got a special announcement today, something that I think is, I think people are going to be pretty excited about. Frankly, I'm excited about it. You know, 11 years ago, I started doing this show on a regular basis. Prior to that, of course, I had done it as a fill-in on occasion, as a guest when it was on Air America Radio, and then Air America went under. This show continued on terrestrial radio, and I joined Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy, who were the co-hosts at the time. This was 11 years ago, almost to the day. And it was my great honor to be working with both those guys and to join a show that had been really established and was really appreciated by our affiliates. And then terrestrial radio became harder and harder to manage. Bobby and Mike both went on to do other projects, and I have been hosting this show, I honestly don't know, but for several years, and really appreciated the audience that we built and the work that our producer, Scott Milliken, has been doing for now 15, 16 years on this show. But all good things come to an end, at least my participation anyways. This show will continue, but I am going to be stepping aside, focus more on the Majority Report, which we do every single day. And you can catch that at majority.fm. We do it live at noon. And then, of course, it's a podcast. And like I say, Emma Vigeland and I do that every day. So there's 15 hours a week. But it is both an honor, and I couldn't be happier about leaving you in the most capable hands ever. He already does the Ring of Fire show on YouTube, and it is only fitting that he take over this show. Of course, I'm talking about Farron Cousins. Hello, Farron.
Hello, Sam. Thank you for that that wonderful welcome. And of course, thank you for everything you have done for us here at Ring of Fire for 11 years. It doesn't feel like it's been 11 years, you know, by any stretch.
I know, but it.
Especially going back to the early Air America days. And it's weird to think that even that has been off the air for, you know, well over a decade at this point. That still feels, I still remember all the chaos that came along with.
There's a certain trauma that we're still living through from those years.
For real,
They were outsized indeed. But I'll tell you what, let's go through the news. And then, you know, that will be my parting news segment. And you will then be captaining this ship. It would have been nice to have had my last appearance as a host. Hopefully you'll have me on occasionally, but to be able to say that the most anticipated legislative accomplishment by that we could anticipate or expect by the Biden administration, that would be the so-called Build Back Better bill, the reconciliation budget bill, has not been resolved as of today. I don't know if it's frankly if it's ever going to get resolved. What started out as, if you were to believe Joe Biden, a $5 trillion bill. And maybe if you had believed Joe Manchin, a $4 trillion bill. Bernie Sanders wanted a $6 trillion bill, then went down to a $3.5 trillion bill. This is, of course, over the course of 10 years, just as, you know, a frame of reference. If we were to calculate the Pentagon budget that way, it would be closer to $8 trillion over 10 years. But this is the nature of living in a an imperialist empire. And now, you know, people are talking $1.75 trillion. We don't even know if that's going to pass, frankly. And it's hard to know what's still in there, frankly. And it's, I don't know, I find the whole thing rather depressing. And I think the real question is, should progressives even support this bill? I mean, should they vote for it?
I think that's a great question. And, you know, you go through social media, I spend way too much time reading Twitter, not necessarily tweeting as much as I think, but there's everybody's got their quick, easy answer. Like, yes, absolutely, you vote against it. Or yes, absolutely, you vote for it and you give them whatever. I think at this point, it's a lose-lose situation that the Democrats created for themselves for no apparent reason other than to appease some donors here and there. But if you do not pass this, if you give nothing to anyone, that spells disaster for the midterms. If you give people crumbs when you've promised them this feast that we were supposed to be receiving, that spells disaster for the midterms. So I do think, you know, just me personally, at this point, I think the best course of action is to vote it down. I think it's almost insulting what it's become. You know, we can't even get paid parental leave in this anymore. You know, instead, they want to have this plan where you, the worker, you have to pay into it. And then when you take your leave, you're basically paying yourself. So your paychecks are going to go down in order for you to get the paid leave under the way the proposal is right this minute, which, again, changes by day here. So we don't know what's going to finally be in this thing. But it's a disaster, and it didn't need to be. It didn't have to be. And it is really disappointing to see all of the wonderful pieces of it day by day get stripped out as the entire base just continues to feel more and more depressed about what we're left with here, which is nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I have never felt, frankly, that this bill was going to make a difference, at least in terms of the material benefits that it provides relative to the midterm elections. In other words, I think I think the real value about this bill was the material benefits it was going to provide. It would start, in terms of a long-term assessment of the Democratic Party, that they actually deliver. You know, I think most voters who are going to vote in the midterms probably have no sense of what was supposed to be in the bill, what was in the bill, whether they're going to get anything from the bill, whether that would have made a decision for them in terms of voting in the midterms. I think it's going to depress the activist base without a doubt, and that is problematic in a midterm election. The real problem, it seems to me, is that the country needed these provisions badly, and I don't think we're going to get another bite at this apple for another maybe decade, frankly. And when it, you know, and I think there's, we're going to have recriminations and people are going to be talking about blame. I really believe that the Biden administration, despite the fact that they had said over and over again, we learned our lesson from the Obama years, that the moment Joe Biden invited the Republicans to make a proposal to come to the White House and they left empty handed, and then he just opened the door for Sinema and Portman to come in and do this. I think at that moment, that is basically when more or less it was Johnny ball game for this. And, you know, easy to say in retrospect, although at the time, I distinctly remember Heather Parton and I discussing on this very show, the iron is hot. This is when you strike. I mean, do you remember what they, when the COVID relief bill passed, do you remember what the Republicans were talking about at that time? Dr. No. Seuss.
Oh, yes.
They were talking exclusively about Dr. Seuss. And at that time, there was a tremendous amount of momentum. Joe Manchin was still talking $4 trillion. He had not amassed, I mean, you know, it's like the best example I can give. I've given this metaphor multiple times now. It is a hurry up offense. You get up to the line, you know, in football, and the defense is, you've got two guys still on the bench. They haven't even run into the field yet. Nobody's figured out what they're going to cover. Like, that was the time to strike. But instead, the Biden administration still had this mentality of, we need to project like we're trying to be bipartisan. But the bottom line is, no one cares. All it did was to give time for those forces who array against it, whether it's corporate Democrats hiding behind Manchin and hiding behind Sinema, or whether it was Republicans, or whether it was corporations, or whether it was big donors, whatever it was, they were unorganized. They were not prepared to fight the reconciliation bill at that time. But Schumer and Biden blew it. there's plenty of other blame to go around. You talk about this millionaire tax. We'll see if he actually gets in there. Certainly Nancy Pelosi was against it. That gives other people, you know, some sense that they can be against it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the bottom line is, if the Biden administration, if they really wanted to pass this bill, which I, it would be, there is no rational reason why you would, propose a $3.5 trillion bill unless you want to pass it, because if they'd come out with a $2 trillion bill, maybe pared down the different things that were going to be in it, and, you know, were to pass that without any changes, they'd be hailed as, you know, as victors. But you're right. Like this whole thing where you have failed to manage expectations for voters out there, all they hear is nothing's getting done. Nothing's getting done. The Democrats can't do anything. I'm going to move on. And they're going to go back and they'll vote for Republicans. I mean, hopefully, you know, and so this has been, I think, in many respects, a disaster. Although, let me say this, and I'm sorry to dominate this conversation, but it's the last time I'm going to be on Ring of Fire as a host before I hand it over to you. The one, you know, I there'll be plenty of time to bemoan the loss of the material benefits that we were getting, whether it's paid leave, whether it's free community college, whether it's we don't know if there's going to be pre-K or preschool or, you know, sufficient help on the elder care. We're talking about expansion of Medicare, both in terms of age and in terms of benefits. Age is definitely out. Benefits is on the teetering on the brink. Locking in Medicaid for those states that didn't get it because of their Republican leadership. I mean, on and on and on. But purely as a political matter, I think the other thing that happened this week could have more salience in the midterm elections, and that is this revelation. And we knew, you know, some of the stuff around the edges, but there seems to be at least multiple witnesses, according to this Rolling Stone piece, that there were at least multiple congresspeople, Republican congresspeople, who were meeting and planning with organizers of the January 6th rally that turned into a riot and an insurrection. And that, to me, seems like could be a big deal at midterms.
Well, you know, that may be one of the only things that really does save the Democrats, is just how horribly dysfunctional, and as we find out more and more each day, corrupt these Republicans are. The Republicans who are essentially, you know, these are a lot of the up and comers. You have Lauren Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Gosar, Biggs, and of course Gohmert, always in there with them. But yeah, we learn that they're actively coordinating with these individuals, along with Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff at the time. Katrina Pearson was acting as what they called the liaison between the organizers and the White House. So we don't know exactly who all, I guess, in the White House was a part of this. We do know, obviously, Meadows is there. And you have to imagine there's no way that this didn't go all the way to the top. But, you know, we'll get there when more evidence comes out. But the biggest problem of all of this, and the indication that they knew something horrible was going to happen, was when they said that Gosar promised them blanket pardons. That was the term they used, blanket pardons. You don't offer somebody a pardon if you're not expecting them to go ahead and do something that's illegal, you know, in some form or fashion. So to me, now we need to look at communications, which I know the committee is trying to get their hands on, communications between Gosar and the White House. Was he actively talking about this? Was this a plan that had been discussed to get these pardons from Trump for these individuals? What did Mo Brooks know? You know, he was also one of the people they were meeting with. He knew enough to wear body armor to go give his speech. So you know, that also,
that's pretty telling. That's pretty telling.
I mean, I don't wake up and just put on body armor because I feel like, you know what? I got a weird feeling. No. They knew something wasn't right. So that's the next piece of the puzzle that has to be put in place.
And we should say, like, let's just put aside the question of whether or not it reached the White House. I mean, obviously, Meadows is the chief of staff. Maybe he was just running this operation outside. But you have multiple members of Congress who were very much aware that they were trying to intimidate. And exactly in what manner, we don't know. But they were very aware that they were trying to intimidate the lawmakers to reverse what they needed to vote on during that moment. Okay. Whether that meant storming the Capitol or just being outside the Capitol. I mean, this was an attempt to intimidate lawmakers literally in that moment. And I suspect ultimately what we're going to find is many people were involved in creating the context. And then a smaller group of people were involved in the idea of what they were going to use that context for. And I don't know, you don't need the 1,500 people who stormed the Capitol to know what the plan is. You just need a small group of people who are going to be like, we're going to get these people worked up. They're going to be there. We're going to march to the Capitol. And then a select group of people are going to open up the doors, push open the doors, smash open the windows, you know, beat up a couple of cops, get in there and let, you know, just sort of the momentum take its toll. But I mean, here's the thing. Republicans for years have been very, very effective at, even during midterm elections, having someone to vote against. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, AOC. I mean, they the Dr. Seuss, whatever it is, it's going to be, a critical race theory. Democrats have never been able to do this. Never, ever, ever, ever. I mean, AOC in the last midterm elections, she had more awareness, name recognition amongst conservatives than she did amongst or Republicans than she did against Democrats, because they are very good at creating boogie people to run against. Democrats are very bad at that. You recall, Barack Obama. I mean, you remember when we were at Air America in 2004, in 2004, 2005, I was getting phone calls about Bill Clinton. He hadn't been in office in 5 or 6 years. Barack Obama wanted to shut the door on that within 18 months. This is the first time that I recall, as an adult, that the Democrats have a ready-made boogeyman to run against, because that boogeyman has not left the scene. Now, they're not doing this on their own. This is literally a turnkey handed on a platter, and that is Donald Trump. Donald Trump drove Democratic voters out in droves in 2018 and in 2020. I mean, record numbers of off-year elections. And he was not on the ballot, but people felt like they could vote against him by voting against Republicans. We have the same dynamic here. And the way to push Donald Trump to the forefront is through this January 6th commission. It is for, and we're going to find out on Tuesday of next week whether this strategy has some legs when we look at what's going on with the Terry McAuliffe race in Virginia. I mean, that is going to be very telling. And we're going to get a sense of just how bad things are going to be for Democrats, because it's midterm elections are always bad. We're going to get a sense of how bad they are. But they have a ready-made boogeyman, and they need to run against this guy.
They absolutely do. And, one of the reasons that I get annoyed with some of this every now and then is because there's no reason why we shouldn't have ads going right now, because it's not just Donald Trump. When you have these, halfway unpopular, I guess you could call them, Republican governors who are little Trump lights, especially Abbott and DeSantis, Texas and Florida, we could be running ads nationally because these people are, not universally liked outside of their areas. We could be attacking them and saying, this is what Republicans are. These are Republicans who want to take money away from school districts because they want to protect children. They, they're banning transgender athletes, which isn't even a problem, but they're doing it because they need to hate something. And of course, we tie Trump in. We run ads with the footage from January 6th. I rarely tune in to news programs. And that day, I mean, I'm sitting right here in this chair and I'm watching this unfold in these live streams. And it was horrifying. I'm getting calls from my mother, freaking out about this. She's, I've never seen anything like this. And people have to remember that, though. They have to remember how they felt when they were watching this on TV. And the best way to do that is to run these ads and tie in the new information, tie in the Rolling Stone info, show their pictures on the screen. These Republicans have been, you know, alleged to have been coordinating with these people. And to your point that you didn't need everybody there to know what was happening, you know, that also makes more sense when you think about Lauren Boebert tweeting out Pelosi's location during all of this. You know, who was that a signal to? Why are you tweeting this out? Was it just like, oh my God, they moved Pelosi? Or was it a wink and a nod to somebody you knew was
out there? Of course. Of course. Yeah. Of course. And so, I mean, there is, and you know, like I say, there's two aspects to this. There's the substance and then there's the political salience of it. And I think both are extremely important. If you do not hold people to account for attempting to essentially overthrow an election, man, they're going to do it again. And I frankly, I'm not convinced that they're not going to do it again, even if you do hold them to account. But certainly they need to be held to account. I mean, and we're watching this, you know, in slow motion across the country as we see another audit taking place. And now in Wisconsin, I mean, they're doing these audits to lay a predicate. And what follows and answers that predicate, we're going to see, you know, sooner rather than later. But there needs to be a full investigation. This needs to be aired out. And it also, it is smart from a political standpoint. You need to hold people to account. You need to let the public know what is at stake here in the midterm elections. I mean, we are, you know, I can't help but feel we may be, like I say, a decade away from getting the sort of the material substantive benefits that the Democratic Party, you know, sort of hints around delivering. And we need, I think, a new generation of Democratic leaders. In my experience, people under the age of 45 have a much better sense of who the Republican Party is than the leadership we have now. There is a big vacuum, it seems to me, from the ages of 50 to 70, 75 in the Democratic Party. You know, to a certain extent, the greatest generation, as it were, and the boomers sort of inched out, you know, made it difficult for people my age to take leadership in the Democratic Party. And we need to wait until those people who are like in their 30s and their 40s ascend to the leadership of the Democratic Party, because they have a better sense of who the Republicans are. And frankly, they also have a far greater jaundiced eye towards our capitalist system that has, you know, really failed millions upon millions, tens of millions of people in this country, arguably hundreds of millions of people. And so, well, you know, we'll see if the Democrats get anywhere with this January 6th investigation. We'll see if they're able to leverage this for political reasons. But Farron, this is my signing off. Who's your first interview going to be on the revamped and, dare I say, improved Ring of Fire?
First guest coming up today, really great guy, Jordan Cheriton from Status Quo. He's been with the John Deere workers. He was actually in Buffalo earlier this week as well, with speaking with India Walton. So he's, you know, been on the ground covering a lot of these issues. So we're going to get a handle on what's actually happening out there outside of DC, because there's so much more happening in this country right now than just, you know, budget arguments between Democrats behind closed doors. You know, there's real world struggles with these workers. So Jordan and I are going to get deep into that and find out what's happening with this Striketober, if you will.
Well, good stuff. Farron, good luck with the show. I couldn't be more confident in leaving this show in your hands. And I wish you great luck over the next 11 years of this program.
Thank you for everything you've done for us, Sam. And I know you guys over there at Majority Report are just killing it every day. Over 1 million subscribers. So, you know, you guys are doing phenomenal work. So thank you for that and for everything here at Ring of Fire. Thousands of workers across the United States this month have gone on strike in what is being referred to as Striketober. One of the biggest strikes happening right now happens to be taking place with the John Deere workers. And I have Jordan Cheriton from Status Quo News with me. Jordan has been on the ground with the striking workers, among many other places, by the way, that he's been in just recent days here. So, Jordan, welcome to Ring of Fire.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem. So lay out for us, because you've been there, you've talked to these workers, you've been interviewing them. Lay out what is happening specifically with these John Deere workers.
Yeah. So the last time they went on strike was 35 years ago, actually, when I was born. And essentially, John Deere, like a lot of these corporate Goliaths, has tried to create a two-tier system. Back in the 90s, they created a two-tier system where current workers, that is, in the 90s, would get XYZ. And new workers would get far less. So that's gone on not only with John Deere, but other corporations, other unions, for decades. And essentially John Deere is now, about to make $6 billion in profits, which would be a record for the company. But their workers are working, you know, 10 to 12 hour shifts a day, three Saturdays out of the month. So, you know, missing valuable family time, long hours, and John Deere has only offered them basically a couple dollars extra over the next 5-6 years, with which, if you compare it to what they were making 10 years ago, and then inflation, is actually a pay cut. So this is kind of the story of America. This corporation is making money hand over fist. The CEO has made an increase of 160% of his salary during the pandemic, while these workers risked their lives. So they finally had enough, and they've been on strike now for about 2 weeks in various plants, locations in Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, and Georgia. And the vibe I'm getting from them is there's an energy among these workers and other workers that you really haven't seen from the working class, labor, in decades. And that is, we're in this for the long haul, and frankly, you know, what more do we have to lose?
And we've seen it a lot, you know, with, we've got the John Deere workers. We had, was it the Nabisco workers? We almost had, you know, the writers go on strike here. And so there's a lot of this, it seems, going around. And this is unusual, right? We get strikes here and there, but what's happened this month with just so many different industries, the workers finally standing up and saying, this isn't good enough. This isn't acceptable. What do you make of that? You know, why suddenly now do we have this widespread, you know, Striketober, really?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to play armchair psychologist, but I do think there's two factors. One is a 40-year neoliberal, you know, bank robbery, which was taking, you know, stealing these workers' wages so that these CEOs, senior executives, you know, all the donors to the various parties could, you know, bathe in money. And the other part, I think, for everybody was kind of COVID, because I think COVID, obviously, from the health standpoint, but just mentally, I think people really started to snap out of this kind of programming that they've been fed. Just be happy for a job. Just be happy for some benefits. Just be happy that you could get maybe a couple days to a week vacation a year. That is what I was told by many workers, that is basically what they've been fed and what they've been conditioned to believe from, you know, the companies, from the media. But COVID kind of shattered that, because all of the inequities, injustice, corruption of our country was just right there for people to see, for people to feel. And I think COVID really kind of was the last straw for a lot of these people, particularly the John Deere workers, to say, yeah, no, it's not good enough just to have a job, just to have benefits. We risked our lives, and we actually see that this company is making record profits while we risked our lives. So I think that was kind of the tipping point. And obviously add in just 20, 30 years of concessions to all these corporations.
When you also end up too, you know, and I like your term, the armchair psychologist, because, right, I mean, we don't know for certain what happens with everybody, But I've talked about that plenty of times too, with just the way that COVID hit and suddenly everybody's life gets disrupted. And we've seen both the negative and, believe it or not, the positive consequences of that. We have had people who, you know, were home for 18 months or longer, and they realized, you know what? This is what I want. I need to find something better for me that allows me to have this kind of life with my family. And, or, you know, the people who say, listen, you want me to come in when you've got a deadly virus, you know, just running rampant. You're not going to protect me. You know, you're going to force me to work in these unsafe conditions. This is absolutely not acceptable. And I can see it now because it's outside the norm. When you go in every day and you clock in at 8 and you clock out at 5 and then you do it the next day and so on and so forth, you get used to that routine and you overlook a lot of these small things because they don't all happen at once. And then with COVID forcing people into these conditions, it did all happen at once. They got to see firsthand just how poorly they are treated in some of these industries. And I always think of the Smithfield pork plant is a phenomenal example of how horrid those working conditions were. So I do think that also plays a lot into it, as you talked about here. And I think another point too is eventually everything does hit a tipping point. You know, you cannot just continue to screw workers over decade after decade while those CEOs and those executives and the shareholders are making money hand over fist without eventually it coming to a head. You know, I mean, and there's an index that actually kind of predicts when things like that will happen. I forget the name of it, but this was a long time in the making, and right, it just finally hit this tipping point.
I think there's also a component, because I spoke with a lot of workers, you know, I didn't, you know, say, show me your papers if you're a Democrat or Republican. But, you know, there are definitely splits among the workers. Some were kind of Bernie people, some were Trump people. But many workers I spoke with, honestly, part of why they've decided to take action is because they're kind of just fed up with the electoral system. I mean, most of these working class people, they are not like the online left. You know, they're not like watching these shows. They're not consuming politics as much as you and I and your audience. They're just working people, but they're smart enough to know, you know, obviously the Republican Party has not done much for them over the years, economically. And the Democratic Party has kind of virtue signaled, and spoken good words about unions, about, you know, lifting wages and all these things, but at the end of the day has not delivered or even tried to deliver. I spoke with a lot of workers who frankly are smarter than most of the, you know, bloviators on CNN, and they know, I mean, NAFTA, the, you know, attempts by the Democrats for the TPP. So I think there is definitely a component of this that are workers just finished waiting for politicians to lift their wages or fight for them and are just taking measures themselves.
And we see that, I mean, literally happening right now in DC with these ongoing, you know, so-called negotiations, if you will, for the Build Back Better Act. You know, we started several months ago a $6 trillion bill. Now we've got something that's under $2 trillion that offers crumbs to individuals after we just promised them in the election. And even after the election, we promised them a feast. We're going to give you all these great and wonderful things. We're actually going to make your lives better. Don't you worry about it. And now we can't even get their own party in line. I mean, you know, Joe Manchin comes out and says, no tax on billionaires, even though there's not a single billionaire in his home state of West Virginia. So he's fighting for people that can't even vote for him, but they can damn sure give money to his campaigns. Same thing with Sinema. And so people get nothing. And that stokes anger. And that, you know, is going to probably exacerbate some of these issues that we see with workers around here, because they understand my boss isn't taking care of me. The company's not taking care of me. The government's not taking care of me. It's on me. And we have to band together as workers, as the majority, to make something better happen for us.
Absolutely. And, you know, honestly, there's a human element where you're not, you know, you're not going to really see this in the New York Times write-ups, the very few write-ups. But frankly, I mean, I've spoken with a lot of these workers. I mean, marriages are breaking up because the husband or the wife are missing too many things because they're working night and day at John Deere and weekends. You have, you know, drug addiction. You have alcoholism among workers because literally the work is backbreaking. I mean, these are not office jobs. No disrespect to office workers. You're on machines all day, using your body all day. A lot of times they're called in last minute. So they're doing in some cases 7 days a week. So these are workers that even before the pandemic, physically and mentally, are basically they're doing the job of multiple people and being told to accept crumbs. So when you're in those conditions, and this is not just the John Deere workers, we're seeing this with Nabisco, Frito-Lay, the coal miners, I mean, Amazon workers that are fighting back. It's a little hollow when you're experiencing that, when the messaging you're getting is, well, vote for us because Trump. I mean, yeah, Trump was awful and it's great that he's gone. But if you continually, as workers, are not offered anything more than that in actual concrete policy, I mean, you just mentioned this shell of a reconciliation deal that at the moment, I mean, is just a joke. If these workers across the board, not just John Deere, are literally breaking their bodies and their minds and stress on the family, and they're not getting anything for it. And then, you know, the party that at least verbally is supposed to be for them is not actually delivering. Yeah, you're going to see a revolt. And I, from what I've seen in covering John Deere and some of these other strikes, it really is contagious in a good way. I think what John Deere is doing, what others that are striking are doing, is kind of giving permission to other workers and other places that might have never seen the blueprint for how to do it or felt they could do it to authorize their own strikes.
Well, and you've brought up a great point here, because most of the time when people see headlines about workers going on strike, they're like, okay, well, they want more money. They want more pay. But it's so much more than that. I mean, that is such a great point about this being, you know, backbreaking labor, the toll that this takes on the people's bodies and goes into the personal lives. I mean, after these people retire, if they can ever even get to the point of retirement, they're going to have, you know, problems with their bodies. That's what happens when you do this kind of manual labor up to 7 days a week now. And so if we continue forcing these people to do that, we're not just not paying them enough for it. We're taking away quality of life both now and significantly in the future. And nobody ever thinks about that part, the quality of life of these individuals after, you know, their knees go out at age 50 or their hips are going out at 55. Those are real problems that are going to cause real medical issues for these individuals in the future that are significantly going to reduce the quality of life. And they're not being taken care of to prevent any of that from happening.
No, not at all. And, you know, I'll tell you, I spoke with a woman, must have been, you know, maybe in her 20s, at one of the picket lines. And we were talking and she said, yeah, my father was UAW, John Deere, for many, many years. And, you know, we're close now because he retired, but I never saw him when I was a kid. He was in there, you know, I guess his shift was like, you know, 8 a.m., got home kind of 5-6 o'clock and, you know, had a beer, went to bed. Cause he was so tired. And that story is not, you know, that's not one story. That's a lot of stories of, basically for this American dream or for these, John Deere workers, the sacrifice is their families. And I asked a lot of them, you know, what do you hear? Cause all we hear is wonderful things, you know, from CNBC and CNN. Oh, the economy's coming back. The economy's booming, blah, 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 blah. You know, unemployment number going down, GDP. A lot of these workers, not just John Deere, kind of pop that bubble and say, no, this economy is crap. The unemployment number going down is mostly, you know, non-living wage jobs coming back, particularly in bars, restaurants, you know, hospitality. And on their end, the media, and this is coming right from them talking to me, the media has kind of fetishized that these, you know, union jobs at great American companies like John Deere, or, you know, are great. But they're basically telling me a version of this is an economic Hunger Games. And a lot of them, I think you made a good point, a lot of them are pointing out it's not just about the pay. I mean, John Deere is literally trying to cut, basically eliminate retirement and pensions for new workers. And that's another thing. A lot of these communities are, I mean, John Deere is either the biggest employer or one of the biggest employers. So it's generational. I talked to a lot of workers. Their nephew is just starting at John Deere, or their kid works at John Deere. So that these workers are not going to accept the deal that, okay, for current workers, maybe give them some protections, but for new workers, eliminates their pensions, cuts their retirement in half, and, you know, basically is offering them less than crumbs, because those new workers, in many cases, are their family members.
And that's solidarity. Like, that's what's missing so much from just so many aspects of life here in America, because those workers could just be like, listen, hey, just give us what we need, to hell with these other guys. And we see that in Washington every day. I mean, both parties are doing that. You know, let me get mine. I don't care what else anybody else gets, if they even get anything. You know, oh, climate change, screw it. I'll be dead by then. What's it matter? But these workers are out there saying, listen, you want to give us ours. That's cool. But you're going to take care of these other people, too. And you're going to take care of the future people. We are going to make sure that this entire group is fully taken care of. And that's rare. But that's what unions, you know, at the height of their power, that's what it was. It wasn't just about me and mine. It wasn't about me going behind somebody's back to try to get a pay raise so they couldn't. It was everybody looking out for everybody else, because the rising tide lifts all ships. So it is nice to see that that mentality does still exist to a degree with these striking workers.
Absolutely. And I also think there's another element that's actually helping, like, actual execute the solidarity, because you could have solidarity, but how do you actually execute that? You know, there's been a lot talked about over the last couple of years. I've covered both presidential campaigns, Bernie 2016, 2020, about the small dollar donor and that kind of grassroots energy. Well, that's kind of morphing over to these worker strikes, because you have a lot of mutual aid that's being developed. You have a lot of community aid, local pizza shops, local, you know, popular corporate companies here donating to the workers food, supplies, wood to keep warm, GoFundMe pages where community members are buying in. So I even have heard, you know, there's kind of a system in some of these places for childcare and babysitters, because it is a 24/7 picket line. So obviously you need childcare if the parents are going to be on the picket line. So there is both financially, both, you know, community support for these striking workers that we probably haven't seen. I mean, I covered in 2019, General Motors laid off 15,000 workers in Detroit, Ohio, after getting a $51 billion bailout, by the way. And, you know, the workers were fighting back, but there wasn't such community support. There wasn't, you know, a big pot of mutual aid. There wasn't, you know, donations flooding in from everywhere to kind of give relief to the workers, because obviously they're making less than their hourly wages if they're on strike. Their, you know, healthcare benefits are being cut. So you're seeing all that now, which, you know, not identical to just the straight $27 donation to Bernie, but you are seeing community support and workers in general kind of throwing in with their wallets and their time to support the striking workers.
And I want to switch gears a little bit, because, you know, I've got to ask you, because you're in Buffalo. You interviewed India Walton earlier this week, which is available youtube.com/status coup. Everybody needs to check it out. And if anybody hasn't been following this mayoral race up there in Buffalo, New York, this is kind of a exhibit A, I guess, of what is happening with the Democratic Party, because India Walton wins the primary. There's no Republican running against her. So, you know, basically she should be a shoo-in as the new mayor of Buffalo. The people already said in the primary, we want her over the moderate Democrat incumbent. So the Democrats are now encouraging a write-in campaign. And this week, the Republican Party also joined in and is now encouraging their Republicans to write in the moderate Democrat instead of India Walton. So kind of tell us, you know, you talk to India, you're up there in Buffalo. What's going on?
Yeah, this is really, I mean, just slap in the face, because it's hard enough for a progressive. I mean, she's, you know, obviously a Democratic socialist to beat a rigged primary. But then when you do, then you have to defeat it again. Only this time with more Republicans, it's a definitely a new mountain for progressives to overtake because, you know, I can't say a lot of good things about Joe Crowley, but at least he, you know, once AOC beat him, he walked into the night as a lobbyist and didn't run in the general election, a write-in candidate. But what's going on here is very simple. The Democratic mayor, like many, are corrupt. He has sold the city to developers and real estate. He, you know, is beautifying the city about 10, 15 blocks downtown, are millions of dollars in investment while leaving the rest of the city to rot. That mayor, because he's been in office for 15, 16 years, took for granted India Walton, just thought he would win in a landslide and didn't have to campaign. So he lost because he took her, you know, he kind of went to sleep on her. So now he's awake and he is galvanizing everybody, the Republicans, particularly Republican real estate developers, Republicans, politicians here to go all in against her. The new poll that came out showed her down 18 points. I mean, if you actually read into it, there's a lot of problems with the actual polling. She is definitely down because the voter turnout is going to go up significantly in the general election from the primary. And basically Brown and other Democrats in the city, the Democratic Party machine is not even subtly encouraging Republicans to come out for Brown, knowing that if Walton gets in there, I mean, the favors, the handouts to developers will largely go away. She's also committed the sin of saying, I want to, you know, increase taxes by 3% because social services are so underfunded. So it really is, you know, kind of similar to what you saw with Nina Turner. The whole machine is against her. Not as much national here, but the local Democratic Party machine is against her and Republicans coming out to try and boost up Brown. So, you know, I wouldn't say optimistic, but, you know, Cori Bush, for example, was down 18 points a week before she upset Lacey Clay. So it is to me still possible that she could win, but it really will depend on two things. Number one, turnout, if India Walton could juice up turnout in some of the lowest turnout parts of Buffalo, which is usually the east side, which is very, very impoverished, mostly black. And if the Democratic Party machine here can juice up Republican turnout in the general election for Byron Brown.
And you know, I don't want to compare the Democrats to the Trumpers, but you look at how they don't accept the results of the 2020 election. And then you look at these Democrats, you know, this machine up there in New York that says, well, yeah, we lost the primary. The voters made their choice, but we're just going to totally ignore it. And we're going to back this guy. Like, you can't have it both ways. We can't talk about how crazy the other side is when we're also looking at the will of the people and saying, no, we don't care. We're going to just push this candidate anyway. I mean, I know it's not quite similar, but there's a similar feel to it, at least a little bit, you know, with them saying, okay, you picked her, sure, but that's not what we want. So we're going to do whatever the hell we want anyway.
Yeah. I mean, listen, there's a two-party duopoly in this country. And although, I mean, listen, during Bernie versus Biden, there were Democratic Party heavyweights saying, I would have a hard time of voting for Bernie, even over Trump. I mean, so that tells you for all the, you know, hysteria over Trump over the last 4 or 5 years, and a lot of it completely valid. When it comes down to it, the actual power structure and, you know, the power and the money being threatened, they were openly signaling that they would think twice whether to vote for Bernie over Trump. Not that they would vote for Trump, but they might sit it out. And here, I mean, essentially, Buffalo is one of many. Cleveland, Milwaukee, Flint, Detroit, Pittsburgh. I mean, gentrification, which I call economic terrorism, by the way, is a patronage system. And there are real estate developers, there are political donors that have had it very good from Byron Brown because he has handed them the keys to a city like Buffalo, which, by the way, is the third poorest city of its size in America and has 30% poverty, and child poverty goes into the 40%. So, yeah, they don't want the boat to be rocked. They are threatened by India Walton, even though for all the, you know, fear mongering about socialism, she really isn't. She's not against development per se. She's not completely slashing the police budget. She basically wants to, you know, cover the potholes, fix the structural issues with social services, put more money into youth programs, senior programs. And she has been, you know, basically villainized as a scary socialist for that. But I do agree with you. It shows how hollow the, you know, vote unite. And, you know, once the primary is over, unite, they'll do it. You know, if it's around Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton, if it's around, you know, a strong black woman who's a nurse, who is a mother of four, who had her first child at 14 and still was able to, you know, rise up in poverty to become a registered nurse, nonprofit executive, to that, to them, she is very scary because they will not be able to get their real estate deals as easily. They will have to go in the back of the line instead of just having handouts. And that's kind of the story of America that I see, gentrification and essentially a tale of two cities in cities like Buffalo.
Jordan Cheriton, Status Quo News. I appreciate you talking to us today, and everybody, listening to this and watching it on YouTube. I just want everybody to understand Jordan and the folks at Status Quo are some of the few people that are actually going out there and getting the stories. Okay. They're not waiting for somebody else to report on it. They're out there. They're making the news. They're uncovering things. Jordan, your reporting on Flint, Michigan has been absolutely some of the best we've ever seen. So I want to thank you and everyone at Status Quo for all that you do. And of course, encourage everybody. It's youtube.com/statusquo. Check them out. Subscribe. It is absolutely top-notch content there. So Jordan, thank you very much.
Thank you. As I'm sure you know, YouTube likes to hide independent channels, particularly those that actually go out and report on the evil and corruption of the capitalist system and our corrupt politicians. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of our own subscribers don't even see when we post the video or when we are live. So, yeah, I appreciate you having me on, and I hope folks will go subscribe, Status Quo on YouTube, and check out our reporting.
Jordan, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Before I sign off today, I do want to take another moment just to thank Sam Cedar for everything that he has done for Ring of Fire, both professionally and personally, because he hasn't just been a host of Ring of Fire. He's been a good friend to all of us here for many, many years. And of course, that relationship is not going to change. We're still going to be hopefully good, close friends with him, hopefully still doing work with him throughout, you know, the coming years. So, Sam, thank you for everything. And of course, for everybody listening, don't forget, please do subscribe to Sam's YouTube channel if you have not already, youtube.com/Sam Cedar. That's going to get you to the Majority Report. And while you're on YouTube, make sure you subscribe to the Ring of Fire channel, youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. I put out new videos 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Doesn't matter, holidays, vacations, we still have fresh videos for you every single day. Even managed to last year record some during a hurricane and get them up there. So no matter what, I'm pumping out fresh content for you every day. That's youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Subscribe, check out our membership levels. And of course, you can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/TheRingOfFire. Exclusive videos for our YouTube community members and patrons on Patreon. So check that out if you haven't already. I am Farron Cousins. I am your new host here at the Ring of Fire podcast. Thank you for listening today, and I'll see you again next week.